I am Dennis Krause. I'm Chief of Head and Neck Surgery at Northwell Health in New York, and I'm going to be moderating this panel. I'm very fortunate to have two esteemed individuals, Dan Deschler, who's the Vice Chair for Academic Affairs at Mass Eye and Ear here at Harvard in Boston, and then Eric Gendon, who's Professor and Chair at the Mount Sinai Healthcare System up the road from me in New York City. And they are going to each be presenting, as will I. And then if time allows, we have a couple of cases to present. As many of you know, and I hope you picked up your pads on the way in, we are an audience response system room, and we're going to ask that you participate in that. And the way that the college has set that up is that initially we'll have you answer those questions before each of the presenters talks. They'll give their talk, and then we will ask you to again answer those questions to see if we've been able to move the needle at all. Please don't forget that there are online CME questions that you need to answer to be able to claim your CME credit. So with no further ado, we'll go to Dr. Deschler, the questions associated with Dr. Deschler. Should be two questions. Outstanding. All right, so some easy questions, just some basic things to make sure that the system is working. What is your current position, if you could answer that? All right, so the majority of people here are surgeon practitioners. Okay, next question. Current practice setting. Something tells me you didn't need the full 10 seconds for this set of questions. So here we have kind of an array of responses across all practice domains. Next question. So this is our first question. 35-year-old woman with no significant past medical history presents with a slowly growing, painless neck mass located in the upper neck at the anterior border of the sternocleidomastoid muscle. She does not smoke, uses occasional alcohol, and has three healthy children. She notes a family history of relatives having lumps in the neck, but has no specific information. Which of the following is not a reasonable imaging option in the initial evaluation of a neck mass in this adult? And the options are ultrasound, neck CT with contrast, combined PET CT, or neck MRI with contrast. Yes. Okay. Thank you. Thank you for asking that. All right. So, correct answer is in fact C, 83%. So, any of either the cross-sectional imaging or ultrasound techniques are considered first choices. Certainly in New York City, it would be very difficult to obtain a PET CT without a tissue diagnosis. Second question. 58-year-old man presents with a slowly progressive neck mass in the upper jugular chain over the last 4 months. He has no symptoms and is in excellent health except for mild hypertension. He has a 10-year past history of tobacco use but quit smoking 25 years ago. He occasionally uses alcohol, married, three grown children. Most likely diagnosis is A, malignancy, B, reactive lymphadenitis, C, branchial cleft cyst, D, carotid body tumor. So again, to my eyes, A would be correct. 82% of people in this demographic are going to have some form of malignancy in that upper neck node. So again, with no further ado, Dr. Deschler is going to speak with us to us today about evaluation of the neck mass. Dan?
Thank you, Dennis, and thank you all for being here today. It's a topic dear to my heart. As I was putting this together, my initial thought was to do this in the classic fashion. We'll go over the demographics, we'll go over the traditional risk factors and things like that. But you know, this is an educated audience. So you've been practicing this for quite a bit of time. We all have. So, you know, how can we, you know, be helpful in this situation? So I'm going to assume that there's this standard knowledge base, which you all have and are all practicing with. Now, as we go on, I just want to say I have no conflicts of interest or any disclosures to make. And so as we approach this, we're going to talk about the evaluation of the neck mask. And then throughout the talk, there'll be certain areas that come up in yellow. And these I've sort of labeled pearls and pitfalls in the evaluation of the neck mask as we move on. Because as we look at our goals in the clinical evaluation and the clinical interaction with a patient with a neck mask, we really want to try to help diagnose and treat what they have going on, what brought them in. And if we are going to intervene, we want that intervention to be appropriate. And there's different means of intervening. One could be to refer to another practitioner who specifically manages, you know, the entity involved. And the other could be, you know, bringing our surgical skills into play with either an incisional biopsy, excisional biopsy, or some other surgical intervention. Key in this is that we do not want to cause harm to the patient, you know, core in our ethos as physicians. But another thing is that we don't want to negatively impact the ultimate treatment of that patient. And so an example of that would be an incisional biopsy in a metastatic squamous cell carcinoma, from an oral pharyngeal primary that now has a spilled tumor in the neck. If we can avoid that, we'd like to try to avoid that. And again, I will add a little pearl here. Again, new neck masses in adults should be considered malignant unless proven otherwise. And then another thing that I'd like to hopefully address here is that as surgeons, you know, loving to operate, we should not instinctively just go right to incisional biopsy and jump to the end of our interventional line. And I'll sort of offer a framework of how we can do this with the tools we have available. And I think that we have four tools available in evaluating the neck mass. And I use the little thing on the side, Hi-Fi, for younger members. They may not know what that means, but for older members, you know, high fidelity is an important thing in both sound and medical care. So the tools that we have are the history and the physical examination. We then have imaging, fine needle aspiration, and then ultimately intervention. And the tools we'll consider there are excisional and incisional biopsy. So again, with our goals to diagnose and treat and then appropriately to intervene. So when we talk about the history and the physical exam, this is really goes back to our classic training, you know, throughout our medical school and our early residency and our practice experience. You know, it differentiates people what age they are. If they're under 20, we're dealing mainly with infectious and congenital issues. But if we're over 40, we're going to have to really consider malignancies being a primary part of that. The duration of it has importance, and these issues, you know, as we talk about this, will be further vetted in the subsequent talks, but rapid and painful expanding masses, we need to think of an infectious process such as lymphadenitis and viral infections. Similarly, lymphoma can be a rapidly expanding or a very aggressive carcinoma, which will have a fixed quality and potentially affect other cranial nerves in the region. But more often what we have is that classic story of, I just noticed this while shaving a couple months ago, and then it seems like it's maybe getting a little bigger, or we had a family reunion and someone said, what's that lump in your neck, and those kind of presentations. We'll ask for associated symptoms such as dysphagia, hoarseness, and things like that. Habits such as tobacco or alcohol use, previous sun exposure, or family history of neck masses. And then the anatomic location can help us out. If it's a periparotid mass, we're thinking of a salivary gland malignancy, those along the jugular region, those in the posterior triangle. And again, each one has their own manner of working it up. Again, centrally, we're really thyroidally based, the thyroglossal duct cyst, thyroid masses, and then going down the jugular chain to the metastases and neurovascular lesions. Posterior triangle, I do ask you to always consider nasopharyngeal carcinoma in this group, especially in those at risk, such as Asian Americans, specifically from the Canton region of China and Indonesia. Similarly, Native Americans from the Alaska can have this be a common presentation. But what we really want from the physical exam, the question we're really asking is, do we have adequate information from the physical examination alone to intervene? Okay? And that's usually pretty rare. Now, there are certain cases where you might. So you open the mouth up and you look in, there's a tongue cancer. they have a mass in the neck, you know, this is going to be a malignancy with metastatic disease. And then if that's in your practice, you know, realm, then you will treat that appropriately and continue to work it up. Or similarly, if you do not manage head and neck cancer primarily, then you'll intervene by having the appropriate referral. Or if you feel it, and this is definitely a parotid mass, and you don't routinely do facial nerve work, then you may consider referral in that setting. We'll go on to now imaging. So as we look at imaging, we again have the same goals of trying to appropriately intervene and diagnose and treat. As Dennis alluded to earlier, we have three options for imaging. We have ultrasound, CT with contrast, and MRI. Now, I kind of look at this as in the Goldilocks approach, okay? So, you know, one's too big, one's just right, one's maybe quite not quite enough. And so when I look at this, I think that CT provides you the biggest bang for the buck here. MRI's expensive, great soft tissue quality, but somewhat challenging to get, and the quality of the scan itself can be affected by factors, whether someone's claustrophobic, whether they can tolerate being in the scanner. So I think CT with contrast gives you a good initial an initial assessment. And it's also one that you'll find that's translatable to the OR. So you can bring that roadmap to the OR and utilize it. Ultrasound, and it depends on how you're using it in your practice, can give you valuable information about the mass at hand, whether it's cystic or not, and its location to things. But again, I don't find it as helpful in ultimately establishing a differential diagnosis that I can, you know, then look at, teach from, and then take to the OR. And I find it less diagnostic than sometimes CT scan could be. Again, I emphasize that PET CT is not brought into consideration here because PET CT for the initial evaluation is not really one that you would order. Again, and as Dennis alluded to, these are very challenging to get in certain markets because of not having an established cancer diagnosis. I do find in other markets, though, people can get PET CTs at the drop of the hat, so it's kind of interesting. So I'd urge you not to use this as part of your initial evaluation. So again, we go back to the same question now. After the imaging, do we have adequate information to intervene with either referral or surgery? And in specific cases, we may. So we look at this CT scan of a neck mass here, which is enhancing and encasing the carotid. This is consistent with a carotid body tumor. Okay, so we don't need to go on to fine needle aspiration of this. So if you manage this in your practice, then you can go on and manage that. Or if it needs referral, then it can be referred on. You know, I manage these with a vascular surgeon. We do them all in conjunction and have a very nice practice for that and do very well with these. Another case here, you see this posterior neck mass here, consistent with a lipoma. We know that fine needle aspiration is not very effective in diagnosing lipoma or ruling out early liposarcoma. So in this setting, going right to the OR with the imaging study would be a reasonable approach. And then here we have a 17-year-old with a cystic neck mass. This is consistent with a branchial cleft cyst and can be taken for definitive treatment with that. Fine needle aspiration is not mandatory in this situation or necessarily recommended. But if this patient were 45 years old, I think, then you need fine needle aspiration because we're now entering the adult group. We're now thinking of malignancy as a distinct possibility, and fine needle aspiration can be very helpful in that setting. So with the imaging, if we do not take the answer as yes, as going on to a treatment or referral, then we'll proceed with the evaluation. And the next aspect of that would be fine needle aspiration. Now, fine needle aspiration has excellent diagnostic accuracy if you look at the large studies, 85 to 90% accuracy rates. The risk of seeding is really non-existent. We don't see that when appropriately sized needles are used. And that's a question that people will raise for you, like, are you going to spread that by putting a needle into it? You know, I'll often tell them that we don't see that, and a better example of it is actually in your world in breast cancer, because fine needle aspirations are done all the time, and they'll often have known someone who's had that, and then it'll sort of allay some of their fears. One thing about fine needle aspiration that I like to emphasize is you get higher accuracy rates when they're done in a fine needle aspiration clinic than if they're done in the office and mailed centrally to a firm that analyzes them. Because critical to being accurate in the diagnosis is the acquisition of the tissue, the fixation of the tissue, and then having tissue available for subsequent analysis. And that's what the FNA centers are able to do, because the cytopathologist will assess the specimen, see if it's adequate, and then if it's lymphoid and there's a consideration of lymphoma, they can take tissue and send it for flow cytometry. Also, they'll be able to do cell blocks, which were available for later analysis for other studies. So I tend to use a fine needle aspiration clinic because I have great access to it and great collegiality with them. But again, if that's not amenable to your practice, just have the understanding that you'll have to have an acceptably lower accuracy rate if they're being done on the outside and mailed in. But these things are important. You know, if you're really considering this as a possible lymphoma diagnosis, then having access to flow cytometry would be very important as you're moving forward. Or if you're looking for other testing such as a P16, EBV, and a thyroglobulin. I will add that little point about thyroglobulin. When a mass is aspirated, and let's say it's a cystic mass, the quality of the fluid can be a tip-off too. So if the needle's put in and clear serous fluid is drawn out, you know, that may be more consistent with a lymphangioma or a lymphepithelial cyst. But if you draw fluid back that's really this dark color, okay, almost like a coffee-like color, those are the ones I send for thyroglobulin, because often those will be cystic thyroid cancer lymph nodes. So it's a little thing that your group can look for. When I approach FNAs, I really try to put the pathologist in the best position to give me valuable information. So I ask them simple binary questions. First question that I really ask from an FNA is this lymphoid or not? So if it's lymphoid, then I ask, is it reactive or is it consistent with a suspicion for lymphoma? And they may indicate that on flow or some other aspect of the evaluation. And then if it's not lymphoid, then it's of some other etiology. That's when we have to open the door and consider things that are potentially metastatic malignancies or other lesions of the area. As you're approaching these and they come, if you get a result that comes back as reactive, in that setting, you can observe the patient, but if it remains after a period of time, you may eventually have to go for diagnostic intervention with excisional or incisional biopsy. So again, with fine needle aspiration, we'll go back and ask our question, do we now have adequate information to intervene after this? Well, if so, then we can go on to surgery. But if not, then we'll go on to a further evaluation with open intervention. And finally, if we look at open intervention, we talk about open biopsy. So if you're going to take someone for open biopsy, and this is one thing I really try to discipline in my own practice and myself as I go forward, is I need to know what I'm potentially looking for, and if where it goes, how I'm going to address that. So I'll just ask a simple question here, and we don't have to raise hands. But how many folks here have taken out a neck mass and had it come back and be something that you didn't expect it to be? And and this happens. And so, but, you know, part of putting all this together is to say, how can we, you know, limit that number? And then when we are potentially surprised, be able to address that. And so I think that if you have a neck mass and you're going for excision or going for diagnostic open biopsy, excisional biopsy should be the first choice. But you want to attempt that without disrupting the mass itself or significantly affecting adjoining structures. And here we're talking the jugular system, the 11th cranial nerve, the 12th cranial nerve, the vagus nerve, et cetera. And frozen section can be used effectively in this setting. So when a mass is removed, we can have it analyzed for frozen section. If it comes back as a metastatic squamous cell carcinoma, we then have the option in that setting to do the completion neck dissection and then not adversely affect subsequent treatment options for the patient. Incisional biopsy, you know, then becomes another matter. You know, here is where we're going to violate the tissue and we can't get out of this without having tissue spillage. So this is completely acceptable in the management of lymphoma, okay? Because lymphoma is not treated surgically. And so if you're going in to remove a node and it's fixed to adjoining structures, your working diagnosis is lymphoma because you've had an FNA that says suspicious on flow for lymphoma, then a reasonably sized tissue segment of about a cubic centimeter at least will be sufficient for that. Another situation is if you have really a horrible metastatic lesion that you're trying to get further tissue on, diagnosis on. So an FNA is said suspicious for malignancy, need more tissue for testing, it's fixed, it's affecting cranial nerves. There you can get in and get the tissue because you're not going to affect subsequent surgery because surgery is not going to be an option for that individual. Again, we want to do this by limiting the extent of a complication and moving forward. So as we go back to our goals, diagnose, treat, then set up appropriate intervention, which again, I think it's important to consider referral. You know, I refer patients with specific things out all the time, and we have great collegiality within the surgical community. And again, we want no harm or to negatively affect ultimate treatment. A couple pearls in this management. Always consider malignancy in this, as we talked about, and if so, be prepared to do a neck dissection. Favor excisional over incisional. And try to limit the collateral disruption during that. Frozen section is a valuable tool. Here's something that I see a bit of on referral, is the well-intended biopsy of the posterior triangle mass. So posterior triangle masses, there's a broad differential for that. But the one thing about them is they're almost uniformly on the 11th cranial nerve. Okay, and so with that, we have to take that into consideration if we're going to intervene. And a lot, I've seen, you know, once or twice a year, I'll see a case where someone's had 11th nerve disruption. And it's almost a classic story. It'll be someone who's young, had a persistent node, they're very nervous. The person's added on to have this biopsied. It's done under local, and then later on they have shoulder dysfunction. So I think if you're approaching the posterior triangle, I always try to have the ability to use nerve monitoring for that, to be able to stimulate for the 11th cranial nerve and be prepared for dissection along the 11th cranial nerve, because a well-intended simple procedure can lead to issue. Another little thing is that sometimes these high anterior jugular nodes are actually parotid salivary gland masses. And so it's important to look at the scans and see whether this is really in the gland or so closely abutting the gland that it's going to require, you know, a 7th cranial nerve dissection as part of what you're doing. So here's an example of a potential pitfall. Here's a 45-year-old state trooper, cystic neck mass. You know, this is malignancy until proven otherwise. This is not a branchial cleft cyst to be taken out, you know, as that with a proposed simple procedure. And then I'll show this one here. This is a gentleman with a persistent lymph node right here. You know, this was right on the 11th nerve and ended up being a metastatic node. So again, going back to our tools, history, imaging, fine needle aspiration, and then appropriate intervention. And if we just sequentially go through this, asking the binary question is, do we have enough information to intervene, with the intervention being referral or potential surgical intervention to move forward, you know, with our goals of diagnosing, treating, and then appropriately intervening. So thank you very much.